Welcome to the Ultimate Farm Wife podcast. On this channel, we're going to be discussing all things marrying a farmer, moving to the land, and becoming integrated with a family farming operation. Whether you're moving to the farm for the first time, or whether you're moving back into a family farming operation, we discuss the ins and the outs of all of it. So let's jump into today's episode. Hi, and welcome to the farm. Today we're talking with Angie about moving to the farm and value adding to the family farming business. Welcome, Angie.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself, your family, your farm, and all the incredible things that you are up to, because you are one busy lady.
Yeah, we've got a bit going on. My name is Angie Armstrong. And myself, along with my husband Mike, run Calibri Station, which is a 28,500-acre sheep and wheat property. And we also have dipped our toes into agritourism, which keeps us quite busy. And we live here with our 5.5-year-old son, Eamon.
Wonderful. Let's start by talking more about the farm, and then we'll go into the agritourism. So can you tell us a little bit of history of the farm, how you both came to be there, and how the sheep and the cropping are going at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So the property's been in my husband's family for about 145 years, so really incredible depth of history. I moved here about 16 years ago, I think we're up to now. I've probably lost a year or two somewhere there. I grew up in Melbourne, was an IT consultant down there, and met Mike through sort of friends of friends. And ended up moving firstly to Dubbo just to, you know, check the relationship was headed somewhere. And then ended up coming out to Ningen and have been here ever since. And it's been quite the adventure.
Yes, absolutely. Tell me about your first impressions of the farm when you first went there, and then did they change from when you then moved to the farm?
Yeah, look, I think when you first move to a property like this, it's all a big adventure. And it wasn't until a few years later it sort of sank in that I was probably going to stay. And so you look at things slightly differently. I also came at the height of a pretty solid drought. So, you know, I didn't really know if any blades of grass even grew out here. It was a lot of red dirt, a lot of feeding sheep. You know, since then we've had floods, we've had rains, and we've had more droughts. So it's been a bit of a yo-yo. But yeah, certainly, I guess the first things I was quite shocked about is just the expanse and how flat it was. I grew up in the Yarra Valley, which is sort of rolling green hills and vineyards, so quite different country. I'd seen a lot of country Victoria, but not so much of inland Australia and inland New South Wales. So yeah, just the vastness of the properties out here, and it can be quite a harsh country to live in, but it's certainly the red dirt does get under your skin in more ways than one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets everywhere.
It does.
Mine.
You just have to embrace it.
Yes. Angie, has your role changed on the farm to when you first moved there to what you are doing now?
Yeah, look, when I first moved up this way, as I say, my background was in IT consulting, computer programming and databases. Not a lot of that work out this way. So I worked for a little while for Landmark in Dubbo and trained some of their staff in their IT systems, but that involved a huge number of kilometres across the state and was quite exhausting. And then I'd come another 2 hours out to Ningen every weekend. I worked for council for a short period. And then I sort of really discovered my love of cooking. Well, I discovered that a while ago, but I started to realise that maybe there was a business in it. So I thought I'd sort of dip my toe into some catering, and that quickly took off. So I ended up running a cafe in town for 5 years and a mobile catering business. We catered weddings all over the state, in the middle of paddocks and halls and race courses and everywhere. And I guess I've always been sort of involved in the farm, but certainly the food side of the farm has piqued my interest a lot more, and I'm sort of getting a bit more involved in the marketing side of our wool and things like that as well. So I guess coming from the city, the consumer side has always really interested me, and how we sort of bridge that gap that seems to be getting wider and really start to create a shared understanding between consumers and primary producers. So that's sort of, why I'm sort of on the path that I'm on at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. We're about to head into harvest. It sounds like you guys are ready to go as well. What are your top tips and tricks for harvest time, both for the catering side as well as just for making sure that everyone remains calm, safe and collected?
Yeah, I think, harvest is a bit of a crazy time of year and it seems to always catch us off guard. Suddenly it's go time and we're all sort of, jumping in wherever we can, and it's a bit of a juggle. My top tips, I guess, being a caterer, I'm pretty good at cooking big quantities of food. So I've sort of worked out what freezes well and what doesn't. So we have a lot of stuff that's, frozen, ready to go, that can be really easily defrosted and heated by someone at home if I'm on a header. The cryovac machine is one of my best friends. I'd highly recommend having one of those in your kitchen. It's just great. You don't get freezer burn. If they're cryovac, probably with no air, they can last, quite a long time. So it's really handy over harvest. And I'm a big fan of lots and lots of snacks in the header because I get very bored very quickly. It's terrible. I often find myself eating my lunch at about 11 a.m. and then it's a really long time till 8 or 9 at night.
And what are your favourite snacks?
I like variety. My husband's more of a sweet tooth, so he will just have all sweet snacks. Whereas, I like all the savoury ones. So as long as I got lots of different variety and I can sort of, change what I feel like snacking on every hour or so, I'm usually okay.
Absolutely. So, Angie, do you share a lot of those recipes and snacks on your social page as well?
We've started to a bit more. I'm shocking at writing things down. I really should have. I've been catering for 15 years and I've, had a few doozies over the years that I should have learnt from and written down so I didn't do again. But I do a lot of stuff just from memory. So I'm a big fan of, tasting things as you go and substituting with what you can get hold of in the supermarket or what's in season. So I'm starting to share a lot more recipes, but really trying to talk to how you can do it without really finite detail as well. So how to balance things just by taste, how to fix if you put too much of something in. So we're starting to share a lot more of that on our website, both on the Cocky's Wife, which is our catering and tourism side of the business, and also Calibri Station. We've also started producing a lot of our own products from, ingredients that we grow on the farm. We've got a market garden. We grow a lot of things from seed. And we also have been doing hydroponics the last couple of winters. So we dehydrate a lot of things. We've been making a lot of, jams and cordials and garnishes and seasonings and things. So, having those things there and then being able to sell them on to people in the community, it makes your meals a bit more interesting but easy at the same time. So not too much prep.
Yes, and I love seeing all of those pop up on your socials. And when you're talking about recipes, I get in so much trouble from my husband all the time because I'm not a recipe follower either. I would describe my cooking method as, shelf cooking. I'm going to look at the shelf and in the fridge and see what's there and what needs using and sort of come up with something from there. So I do enjoy the similarity there with what you're trying to do with less specifics and more doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it means you can, use things up that are in the pantry. And we have a bit of a running joke that I'd be shocking on something like MasterChef because I just have too many choices. I'm much better when there's something that needs using or finishing up, and you have to get a bit creative with that. And it's often where some of the best dishes come from. So,
yeah, yep, absolutely agree with that. And I think that will lead us nicely into the agritourism side that you have jumped into as well, because some of your extra little products that you were just talking about with the dehydrating in your market garden goes into some of the packages that you put towards your accommodation. So tell us about that side. How did it get started? What is it? And how's it going?
Yeah, so we started, it must be about 4 years ago now. I was pregnant with our child, Eamon, which is probably the worst time to start a new business, but why not? There was some funding going through Destination New South Wales for farmstay accommodation. I thought I'd, throw my hat in the ring and see what happened. And it was also a really great process just to do the planning and the business plan and the, you know, competitor analysis and all that sort of stuff. So we were lucky enough to get some funding through Destination New South Wales, and that really helped us with the complex here. So we've built some accommodation called the Sky Suites, which is in refurbished shipping containers, and it's stacked three stories high. Our site is in a flood zone, which is not ideal, but it's the site we've got. So we decided to get creative and go three stories high, which really offers some incredible views across the property and really immerses people in their surroundings. And when we first started, we were looking at doing mostly group-based and charter groups. And, of course, we launched right at the start of COVID, so that threw a bit of a spanner in the works with all the, you know, regulations around that. But we sort of pivoted over a couple of years and had a lot of domestic guests through for the first couple of years. And then just this year we've launched the international market, which is really exciting. And I think we've got a fair challenge ahead of us in terms of trying to get internationals this far inland. I think there's some really exciting opportunities with agritourism, particularly to the international market and promoting broadacre properties. But it hasn't been done a lot in the past. So we've certainly got our work cut out for us in a marketing sense anyway. And, yeah, we've started welcoming guests for sort of more self-contained stays as well. So really catering to the domestic market and also locals that just want to have a luxury stay and a nice grazing board by the pool and don't particularly want to go and see our farm. So we sort of offer two different packages, one that's sort of fully hosted, you know, for people that aren't from the area, and one that's more just sort of, you know, an escape and a nice stay.
Absolutely love that pivot and love the range that what you're doing there. I will definitely be sharing a lot of the images of everything you're doing on our socials when I release this episode as well, because it's just absolutely incredible and multi-layered, and it is, you've done a really great job at describing what it is that you're up to there as well. And so a few questions that I put out to the community was that came back was, how do you get people to your place? Because you look like you're in the middle of nowhere. I was like, well,
yeah, we are. Yeah, look, I think that's probably been one of the biggest questions when we first started is, how are people going to get there and who's going to come? And I think often when you live in an area, you sort of don't notice the things that are really special and amazing about it because you're surrounded by it all the time. And when we first started, I knew it would be one of the challenges because we're not near a big attraction. And there is a fair bit of traffic coming down the road heading to Broken Hill and those sorts of things, but it's very seasonal and not super consistent. So I guess we've worked really hard with groups like Destination New South Wales and Tourism Australia. We've recently joined Outback Beds, and we also work with groups like RDA in Dubbo to really try and raise the awareness of what's out here. I think one of the key things really for me in the years coming is really trying to build a network of other providers and supporting other, you know, small operators to build that network of attractions so that we really start to build the strength of the region in terms of tourism. When we first started, we really envisaged a lot of charter flight groups, and we did have that for the first couple of years. Of course, post-COVID, everyone zipped off to Europe and Bali and everywhere else. So, yeah, there's been a real lull lately, which is why we've started focusing more on our road-based groups. And I think that's probably one of the things that's really important when you're first delving into something like agritourism, particularly in an area that's not really well known, is that you do have to be multifaceted. You do have to offer a few different options, which can be frustrating because you stretch yourself a bit thinner. But it's also important to do to try and keep that consistency in business, you know, to keep staff employed and all of those sorts of things. So, you know, I do think particularly out west here, we have to do that 10 or 20% extra to attract people out this way. But the feedback from the guests that have been here is incredible because it's authentic, it's unique, it's very heartfelt, we're very passionate about what we do, and there's a real connection, a personal connection, which I think people after COVID are really craving. So yeah, certainly the challenge is how we get people here, and we're working very hard at the moment on doing interactive maps by air, so both plane, helicopter, and also by road, and sort of looking at all the places they could stop on the way to us. So really trying to help our travel partners to build us into itineraries. So yeah, it's exciting. I think the more we can partner with other groups and really build the strength of the region, we'll see a real reward for that hopefully in the coming years.
Absolutely. And where do you start trying to organise that? Is that just building your network, or when you sit down to work out, okay, there's so many options, so many opportunities, how are we going to choose what we're going to do?
Yeah, look, I think I really try to focus on organisations that have a similar ethos to what we do. So, for example, we've started looking at private helicopter trips out of Sydney. And because the choppers have to stop and refuel partway, we're now partnering with wineries in Orange and Mudgee region, because that way the guests can land, they can enjoy a beautiful first-hand experience with the winemaker. So we're really trying to focus on that sense of farming and paddock to plate, farm to table, understanding the land and the terroir of the wines and how it affects the flavour and how the seasons affect the flavours. And so, yeah, it's interesting. I think what drives who we partner with is what we're passionate about and the bigger picture and sustainability, and trying to make sure that we partner with people we have a really similar outlook with. And that way, I think when the guests, you know, take those itineraries and follow them, they're seeing a consistency in the theme of the travel as well.
If you're enjoying listening along with us today and learning some tips, tricks and advice, then please like, subscribe and even share this interview with someone who you think would need to hear this information or who might benefit from other interviews done right here on this channel. Now let's get back into today's episode.
So yeah, I remember really early on a marketing specialist said to me, the most important thing you can do to start with is work out who you're for and who you're not for. And I'm still trying to refine that, but it's a really important thing to think about and get right, because it really means that you can hopefully meet and exceed the expectations of those that are coming out to you, and you get people that are wanting all the things that you're offering, but, you know, for example, aren't bothered by mozzies or flies, but, you know, would trade that for a really authentic experience.
Absolutely. And when we're talking logistics of the charters, so whether they're coming out by plane or helicopter, are they landing actually on the station?
Yeah, so we just had our first private chopper landing, which was pretty exciting, very cool. The choppers can land direct on the property, which is amazing, and part of the reason we've started pursuing that market. We've had our fair challenges with access by road, with floods and everything else. We were underwater for about 8 weeks this time 2 years ago. So, yeah, that's one of the great things about choppers, but they are quite expensive. Planes, we're in the process of applying to put in an airstrip. So eventually we will land planes directly on the property. To date, we've been using a neighbour's airstrip and also the two local airstrips in Tottenham and Nyngan, and then we provide private transfers from there. We've also had a lot of road-based groups, and they're usually able to obviously drive right in, except when it rains. So we only have 4 kilometres of dirt, and it caused me endless grief.
Yes, I remember seeing on your socials 2 years ago the floodwaters and just praying that they would subside for you, because that was quite incredible seeing it come right up to your footsteps of the house and everything else.
Well, look, we know that this place floods. That's something that we've accepted. You wouldn't choose this site if you had a choice of location, but the history is here and we want to preserve it and tell that story, so we understand that's a risk and something we'll just have to cope with. Talk to me again when my house goes under, I might have a different story. But yeah, we're just trying to put everything in place we can to sort of minimise the risks. Usually the flood, we have sort of 8 or 10 days notice, so it's not such a big deal. The bigger challenge, I think, and in general for agritourism, is when it rains and councils close the roads, which cancels public liability insurance. So it's really tricky. One of the biggest challenges we're facing at the moment is wanting to provide really consistent service to our travel partners and know that we can get these groups in. You know, we'd love to do opera in our wool shed and bring out vintage trains with hundreds of people, but we need to know that we can get buses down the road. So it's probably one of the biggest challenges going forward is, you know, how do we do that and you know, not wreck the roads experience at the same time. Hopefully with, you know, the outlook for agritourism and how much income that's going to bring into Australia, the government hopefully will start to look at how they can support access a bit better, because I think there's a huge amount of opportunity in rural Australia, but it needs a bit of infrastructure support.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. And while you've brought up the wool shed, that's been another incredible project that you have been working on for at least the last 12 months, isn't it? So would you like to tell everyone a little bit more about that project and what it'll bring to the farm as well?
Yeah, sure. So we've got the old original wool shed from the 1800s, which was built with timbers logged on the property. So it's one of my favourite buildings here. Of course, everything on the Kalubri site, which is the southernmost point of the property, literally metres from the Bogan River, has been under quite a few floods. So it needed a fair bit of work. A lot of the floors were really uneven. It had had a few rounds of renovations and then it needed a few more major ones. So we've re-stumped quite a bit of it. And then I sort of had my work cut out for me. We had a wedding booked here in April this year. And I really was determined to get it finished for that. So I jumped on the saw and the drill and everything else and spent about 4 days in my old volleyball knee pads going along and putting down new floorboards. So, yeah, we've renovated it very rustically, but it's now a beautiful backdrop for weddings and functions and events. So we can sort of, you know, host the event out the front and then everyone wanders through the old timbers with a glass of bubbles and canapes and music playing, and it's a really beautiful space and shows a lot of the pioneering history of the area, which is lovely. And then we've also got our shearer's quarters, which we did up a year or two before that. And that's our function space. So that seats up to about 80 indoors and up to about 150 for cocktail functions. And that's a really lovely air-conditioned space, a little bit more comfortable than the wall shed. And it's got sort of dance floor deck and Chesterfield lounge. And we also use that for our guests that stay here for the farm stay. So it's a really nice dining space with a few luxe fittings like chandeliers and things thrown in. It's one of my passions, is sort of doing up a lot of the older buildings on the property and really showcasing them for events and functions.
Yeah, absolutely. And Angie, how does everything work in? How do you balance everything? How do you get everything done? Because every year you seem to be doing a project and a value add and still working on farm with your husband and running that all alongside with your son. So how does that work for you?
Yeah, look, I think it's a juggle, that's for sure. And I think the moment you accept that it's going to be a juggle, you've made a big step forward already. I remember in my very early days as a graduate IT consultant, one of my managers said to me, Angie, you really need to make to-do lists. And I have to laugh because I must have about 21 on the go at the moment. So, you know, I think out here you've got to be really organised, not get overwhelmed by how much there is to do, because that's very easy to sort of look at it and go, oh, there's just too much, where do I start? And I think choosing something that's achievable each day, so setting a bit of a realistic goal so that you feel like you've really made a dent in it. And we all just jump around jobs. So depending on what's happening, you know, at the time and what the priorities are, you might have to hit pause on something, which can be really frustrating. But, yeah, hopefully sort of, you know, at the other end you get a bit of a hand with one of your projects. So my husband laughs because I'm a bit of a squirrel and I sort of find things over years and buy them and put them in sheds. And it's a bit of a running joke because Mike's grandfather was a bit of a collector as well. But I keep saying to him, there's purpose in my collection. So every time we go to do a new building or a new furnish something or renovate something, I've actually usually got 90% of what I need ready to go because I've planned that far ahead. But I think when you live remotely, you do that, because if you suddenly have half a day free, you can't just zip down to Bunnings. So yeah, it's definitely about having the priority list and the tools and materials ready to go. And then my lists are really divided into depending on who's helping me. So I've got a list for when my husband's round. I've got a list for when Dad comes up. I've got a list for myself and the au pair, and we kind of jump into doing most of the stuff around the house ourselves. So, yeah, just being ready for when you have help.
Yeah, absolutely. I really agree with that, being ready for when help comes and also being willing to ask or set up that help in initially as well is really important.
Absolutely. And there's a couple of There's a couple of great websites on Facebook and groups that you can join where, you know, we've had grey nomads come out and help us for a while in exchange for sort of food and camping and sort of being aware of where that help can come from too. You've got to sort of branch out and think a little bit more broadly in terms of it's not usually just bringing someone in and employing them because there's not often a lot of budget for those kind of things, these passion projects. Just really being aware of, you know, where you can source people from. And we've done a lot of skills swaps, so we'll have people come and build things or do photography or videography or, you know, painting and things, and we'll swap for, you know, food and catering and accommodation and experiences. So, you do have to think a little bit outside the box sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Angie, I'm mindful that you do need to go and get on a harvester in a minute. So one of the biggest questions that I do love to ask is, what was your biggest hurdle on farm and how did you overcome that?
Oh, there's been a few. You know, we've had stinky mouse plagues, we've had floods, we've had droughts. Ironically, those things I tend to cope with okay because they're well out of my control. Yeah. I think probably the biggest challenge I found, particularly as a woman coming out here, was really finding my place and my passion. When I first came out here, I was very wary of not wanting to be Mike's wife and that's it. And just for me, I needed something that I was passionate about and that would drive me. And in a remote area, that can be a bit trickier. There's not, you know, as many ways to, you know, entertain yourself and define yourself. You have to be a little bit more creative often. So I think I just never said no to an open door, you know, noticed what I enjoyed, started to think how that might fit with what we're already doing and where my skill sets already lay. And then it was a slow process. It probably took 10 years before I really felt like I was on a path that, you know, I was passionate about and I could see a future in. So that was probably the most challenging thing I've found on farm. It's not so much the day-to-day environment because there's not a lot you can do about that and it's outside your control. It was more, you know, the things that I could control and finding, a path myself that I knew I'd be happy with. So that's, you know, that's been quite tricky and it's been a very long, slow process and I don't think I'm probably alone in that path.
No, definitely not alone. There is a huge component of the Ultimate Farm Wife community who is there with you or who is still trying to get to that point to find their passion, to find their place. So what advice would you give them? They've married their farmer, they've moved to the land. What's your advice for them?
Oh, I think don't be afraid to try things. Like, you really learn more from your mistakes than you do your successes, which is ironic, but you've got to be prepared for a few failures. And just, you know, when you don't quite hit the mark, go, okay, what didn't I enjoy about? Why didn't it work? And sometimes that can actually guide you towards your end goal more accurately than sitting down and trying to work out, you know, ultimately where you want to be, because it can be a bit overwhelming. So, you know, don't be afraid to dip your toe in and just try something small and often if it's the right thing, it'll grow. You might end up running 10 million things like me. So I don't know if that's good or bad advice, but, you know, it's certainly no one starts out thinking we're going to build a huge wedding venue and accommodation and all of this sort of stuff. It does just kind of snowball a little, but, you know, in a good way. But don't be afraid to just start and wherever you can support other women or other partners coming into a farm marriage, because it can be quite daunting and quite isolating. You know, the more we can support each other, the better the region's going to be. And there's some incredible, you know, skills and backgrounds that come into farming families. But it is often quite tricky to find, you know, how to apply those skills in a totally different setting. So, you know, the more we can talk and share and support and network and promote each other's businesses, that's really, really important.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that 100%. There is so many talents and skills that are in our region and coming into our region, and we need to find where that fits. And we need to encourage that and support that as well, in whether it's our neighbours or our further community. Absolutely, 100% agree. Angie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and talking about marrying your farmer, moving to your land, and the amazing projects that you are up to. You are an absolute true inspiration, and I look forward to the community being able to hear your words and take away some tips, tricks and advice that they can use on their farms. So thank you so much.
Just a reminder that Katja Williams, the ultimate farm wife, is also a Tupperware consultant. Use the link in the show notes to make sure that you're supporting the Ultimate Farm Wife podcast and channel. Whether you are looking for unique pieces for your kitchen, replacement items, or whether you are looking for something suitable to taking food and lunches down the paddock, not only in our current busy season, but also to barbecues, parties, or if you're looking for Christmas gifts, this is the ideal link for you. Thank you very much for joining us in this episode, and we look forward to seeing you in another one.